I met Arnold Clifford a couple of years ago, and we immediately went out around the Biscay. I figured if I'm going to find a place where there's no plants growing and be a challenge to them, we're going to go look at the Biscay. Well, you should see all the plants he found. So then he wanted me to go up to Four Corners where the dinosaur tracks are. So we found the dinosaur tracks. I couldn't believe all the plants around the dinosaur tracks. So every place that I've gone with, years, I think the sage and maybe a few plants that you recognize, and he's pointing them out. The last count I heard, and I don't know how far off I am, he has 27,000 plants pressed and identified. And not just identified like all other biologists do, with Latin and English and then an English common name, but also the Navajo name, the Zuni name, and the Curanderas use, and a lot of other stuff. He's still looking for a home for all this stuff. And that's another long story, I don't want to get into it. We tried to get Dr. Dyer went with us a couple times. He went with us, and we found even more plants, and he even took his dogs along, and his dogs even pee-peed on some of the plants, and that's okay. Now Dr. Dyer is no longer there, but neither is an adequate facility for Arnold. So I guess we've got to work on something else, and maybe our efforts to recycle some of the buildings out of Fort Wingate might come in good stead, because what he has to offer the Southwest in terms of knowledge and understanding and appreciation of the plants that grow in an arid place where most people think, oh, there's nothing but cactus and sagebrush. And I think you'll change your mind a little bit after today. And so again, I want to welcome little good old friend, Yate, and Arnold, it's all yours.
Hello. Thanks for inviting me to give a talk here. I come from a place called Pocavito, New Mexico, about 18 miles west of Shiprock, along the Carrizo Mountain Range. And I pretty much studied the whole Southwest, studying the geology, the botany, kind of like the desert ecology. Also studied like the Navajo culture history. And when I was young, my grandmother just started teaching me about plants when I was about like 9-10 years old. So that's where I started building my knowledge of the Southwest, or right around when I was about 10 years old. I pretty much collect plants throughout the whole Southwest, including the San Juan Mountains, 14,000 feet, all the way down to like 4,000 feet. I've done part of the Sonoran Desert, part of the Chihuahuan Desert, part of the Mojave Desert. Pretty much the whole southern half of Utah. Pretty much the whole Colorado Plateau. The whole Navajo Nation. And one of the things that I'm trying to do is I'm trying to write a flora for the whole Navajo Nation. And that would include I'm looking at probably four different volumes. The first volume, I'm going to take a look at all the geology, the stratigraphy, the structural geology, the geomorphology, the landforms, and how all those together play a role in developing all these habitats with different types of plants throughout the Southwest here. And after that, I'm going to probably go into, for my second volume, I'll probably cover the Navajo ethnobotanical knowledge, which includes all the Navajo names, the Navajo classifications of plants, the Navajo esoteric stories related to different deities that are involved with the plant knowledge. And then the third volume, I'm kind of looking at writing what they call the dicot section, which would include all the grasses, the lilies, the orchids, and all the grass-like plants. And then the last volume, I'm kind of looking at the gymnosperms and also the dicots, which are flowering plants. So I've been working at it for a number of years, so I think 4 more years of field work, I should probably be able to get it done. So that's my foundation. That's what I've been working on, and that's what I I've been doing. And I approach my science from a multidisciplinary type of approach. I don't just view botany in terms of botany. I know a lot of botanists. I work with botanists from east to west coast. And a lot of them, they have their training strictly in botanical training. And a lot of them, they specialize. Like there might be a whole genera called the Astragalus or another genera called the Areogonus, which incorporates like about 500 species in each genera. And so when they specialize like that, once you get them out of that particular specialty that they've been studying, they kind of lose it, you know. They don't really know other plants beyond that. So the way I approached it was what I call floristics, which is the study of all plants, all the grasses, all the sedges, all the shrubs, trees, and flowering plants. So by doing that, it gave me an opportunity to recognize all these different major groups, and it gave me an opportunity to really immerse myself in all the different habitats and all the different forms of plant life that there is out there. So by doing that, when I did that, I started to recognize these huge groups, large groups like the Astragaluses, like the Areogonus. And when I did that, when I became intimately familiar with each one of them, their ecological requirements, their growth form from the colony stage all the way up to what we call anthesis, where they fully flower out and fruit out. So when you become familiar with them like that, you can recognize plants out there when you're walking around saying, oh, that's a new species there. You know, just right out in the field, you start to recognize them that way, saying that plant has never been described just because of the growth form of it. It's different than all the other Astragaluses or all the other Senecios or something like that. So I'm up at that point right now, and that's kind of like my driving force of doing my botany now. And so on my talk, I'll kind of go through a lot of different subjects. I'll go through the first part of what I'm doing now. Then I'm going to go through the part where how I'm preserving some of my specimens. And then towards the end, I'll talk about the novel ethnobotanical knowledge, like medicinal plants, edible plants, tobaccos, and so forth. And then I have a small section in here dealing with some of the latest studies that I'm involving myself in. So this is the general boundary of the Navajo Reservation here. And the place that I'm going to kind of concentrate is up and right in here. But I've done, like I said, extensive work throughout this whole area. And right here is where I live at, right near the Four Corners area. And right now I'm doing my studies right below that A, a place called Cove, Arizona. Next slide. So this is my hometown, my home region. This is where I live at, this is where I've herded sheep, this is where I grew up. This is where I learned all my plants, this is where I learned all my geology. And this is where my grandmother spent a lot of time with me, training me out in the field, just herding sheep and teaching me about all different types of plant life and all different types of, believe it or not, geological features, you know. We have a lot of explanations, you know, Navajo words that we use in like geological geomorphic features and also processes in geology. Next slide. So there's the igneous dike. So we've got a combination of sedimentary rocks, including igneous rocks, a little bit of metamorphism. And all these formations, this is like the core formation, the Wingate formation, and going on up into the Entrada and then up into the Morrison and the lacolithic seals being injected into these sedimentary rocks. Next slide. There's more of a Wingate with a little bit of a Somerville at the top. So Wingate is kind of interesting because it was first described in the late 1890s from Fort Wingate area. It's by Dunton. Dunton was his name. He went out north of the train tracks and he measured these reddish sandstone outcrops out there. So for all these years, the outcrop there has been named the Wingate Formation. And over time, when other scientists, other geologists went out and did other stratigraphic measurements and other stratigraphic descriptions of new rock types. There's several years before there's a rock type described as the Entrada Formation. And so over time, when all these different monographs and papers, professional papers on stratigraphy started coming together, a lot of the stratigraphers, they started correlating these different formations from Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, and Arizona. And then also from Utah, and then also from part of Texas and part of Nevada. So when they correlated these, they found out that what's over at the Wingate, what was considered the type location for the Wingate Formation, really wasn't Wingate Formation. It was the Entrada Sandstone. So right now there's a big dilemma with the name of the Wingate Sandstone. There's really no type section for it now. I think just to save face, just to save the name, they took the bottom part of that Entrada Sandstone where it starts turning kind of ledges and little benches. They included that and saying that that's the bottom Wingate formation. So the Wingate is actually not over here where it was originally described. It's kind of neat thinking about that. Next formation, next slide. Here's the true Wingate formation that's exposed throughout all the reservation area. This is the Bicalpito Dome. That's the central part of the structural dome. There's about 13 different sedimentary rock layers that extend away radially away from the central part of the dome. If you go further, you get into the Dakota Sandstone, then like right over here, then up. This is all the Mekis Formation. There's two different members. There's the lower dark member and the upper light-colored member. And the Mekis is very interesting because there's at least throughout the Southwest about 100 endemic plants that only occur on the Mekis Formation. Right here, the top of the dome, from here to the top of here, I found 16 new state records for the state of New Mexico. These plants, they might have been known from Colorado, Utah, or Arizona, but not from the state of New Mexico. So when I started checking around this Bicalpito Dome area, I found 16 state records there. Next slide. There's a Shabak looking from the foothills of the Bicalpito, from the Carrizo Mountains. Next slide. Okay, we get this kind of habitat there back home too in the Carrizo Mountains. You get these, what they call these lacolithic seals. This is all igneous rock with these deeply entrenched eroded canyons with running water. On the, in the Bicalpito area, the majority of the mountains that we have up in the Four Corners area, like the Henry Mountains, the Ute Mountains, the Plata Mountains, the Carrizos, the Abajos, the La Salles, and Rico Mountain. And so these mountain ranges, they're all a type of mountain range that we consider what we call lacolithic types of complexes. So if you look at my fingers, before there's any deformation, my fingers will be the sedimentary rocks that are horizontally bedded. And the area between my fingers will be like fracture zones and zones of weaknesses like master joints and so forth. So over time you have magmas that starts finding these zones of weaknesses and they start migrating up these zones of weaknesses. And then later on, they find these bedding planes and it'll start adding magma like that laterally. And over time, more magma becomes laterally injected, so it starts doming up the whole mountain like this. So as a result, what you see are these sedimentary layers that are being split apart or pushed open with lacolithic seals. And these are the seals that you see up there in the Carrizo Mountains. So it's kind of a neat interesting feature that we have up there. Navajo Mountain's about 26 million years in age, and then the Henry Mountain's about 46 million. The Carrizo is about 71 million. So what I do is I hike all three mountains to get a very good understanding of how these lacolithic seals were in place and also how they were weathered out over time. So it's a very neat example here. Next slide. And that's what it culminates to. You see these really neat waterfalls. There's two waterfalls. There's another upper waterfall up here coming down to here, and then it drops down here. These are cooling structures, and you can see the sedimentary bedded horizontal bedding plane right here. Then way up the very top, you can kind of see the whitish sandstone that was injected through. So this is called Tisans Musa Canyon. Next slide. Okay, my grandmother. My grandmother was the one that taught me all about plants, all about a lot of this knowledge about the earth, knowledge about how the earth works, knowledge about animals, and about these rug weaving, about how to set up rugs, how to do rugs, and stories on rugs. This is one of her, she wove this in the late 80s or late 1970s. And my brother, you can see his feet down here and his hands up there, so it's a fairly large rug. This one depicts, it's in part of the Buduwe chant, it depicts how coyotes stole fire from black god to give to first man and first woman. Each quadrant has a different deity. Here's black god with his with ceremonial fire. And then here's the thunderbird with the moon. There's coyote with the sun. first man and first woman, Polaris and Cassiopeia, and there's Polaris and the North Star. The rainbows indicate that's how the holy people travel. They'll take out their rainbows and sling it out like that, and they'll go out like this and get across and start walking to where they need to go. So when Coyote stole fire from Black God, you see that red ember trails of red yarn to the tail, and then to the tip of the nose, to first man and first woman's fireplace. And that's to this day, that's why we say that the coyote has a black nose and black tail, you know. So that's where it comes from. Next slide. So here's another inspiration in my life that I kind of found out. This is Yabiche carvings that was done in the 1920s, early 1920s. It was by a fellow by the name of Klitso Deadman. Klitso Deadman was his name. In the 1920s, he owned three trading posts. He owned a trading post at Nazlene, over at Salina, and one in Chinle. And at the time, he was one of the only Navajos with a, he might have been the only Navajo with a vehicle, like he had a Model T Ford. And when 1923, when President Theodore Roosevelt came to the reservation area, nobody had a vehicle to transport him around, so they asked Klitso Deadman to transport him around. So I've seen these old photos of this Navajo with a big old tan gal and hat and President Roosevelt sitting on the side with his wife, you know. And that was my father's paternal grandfather, Shijeb and Nalende, so that's stories that I've dug up about him too. And this one is currently residing at the California Academy of Science with a price tag of like maybe $16,000 or something like that, you know. So very, very old artwork there. Next slide. Okay, let's get into what I do. So this is how I study plants. I often try to take photos of them before I collect them. This is a temporary field press that I use. I can use that press to hike in like many, many miles and collect all my plant specimens all fresh. And I like to say, you know, this is the secret to getting really good plant shots, is getting down to the ground, laying down, putting your elbows down and taking close photos. Saying hello to the holy plant people. You know, these are holy plant people that are dynamic, they're alive. And you talk to them, say, I'm gonna take your photo, I'm gonna collect you for my scientific learning. And you connect with them, and also it's a way for you to hug Mother Earth too, get back to Mother Earth with all. Next slide. So these are my specimens that I've collected. This is a plant that's called Lescarella. It's in the mustard family, the Cruciferae or Brassicaceae. This is potentially a new variety or a new species, so that's why I was in this region collecting this particular voucher specimen. Next slide. So these are what they look like up close. Navajos, we call this Yeitsi, which means the hairs of the holy people, the Yeitis. And also we also call this Wulichi Aze, which means ant medicine. It's used for ant bites, to alleviate ant bites and so forth. Next slide. So this is how I store my specimens. These currently are my unprocessed specimens, still in newspapers. And then once I process them, I put them onto these herbarium sheets. These cabinets here were donated to me from the Swiss, from Harvard University. They're well over 100 years old, super heavy. Took about 5 to 6 people to carry them into my storage area. And you can see the Harvard sticker still on top of the cabinet, so it's a really neat old cabinet to store my specimens in. Next slide. So once I get them done, completed, this is what I have them in. They all have individual folders, genus folders, genus covers. They're all classified based on family first, and then based on genus or genera, and then whatever species are in each genus. So that's how I have these set up and classified. Next slide. So there's a typical specimen that I have, an onion. This one is called Allium goodenii, Gooding's onion. It's federally listed as threatened. One of its range in the local area would be like around the Cibola National Forest. When you get at that McGaffey Road, there's some of those low swells and where you get like, where water will kind of congregate. in the Ponderosa pine forest. That's where most likely you'll find these, but they're still very, very rare. Next slide. So this is my labels, how I save these, preserve these. So I call my entity the Carrizo Mountain Herbarium right now. And then most of these plants are from the four corners, Navajo Nation. So if it's from Colorado, Utah, or Arizona, then I'll put that up there. And then I'll put my description, where it comes from, what plants it occurs with, what soils, the geology, the elevation. Sometimes if I have all the data, I'll include in like township section range or even the GPS data. The more information you have, the better. Because initially, what you want to do is you want to have a specimen for some future researcher. Maybe there's some young botanist or some young biologist that's coming up to see where you collect these specimens from. Because sometimes you have young individuals that go back to studying plants even further. They'll start working on their master's thesis or their doctoral dissertation. And sometimes they'll require like specimens from all over the nation. They'll say, I want to see all the onions, all the Allium Houdinii that was collected from across the nation, all the herbariums. So they'll write to these institutions. They'll send their samples to this individual. And then they'll start reviewing and put them all together on a big old table. And so a lot of work is being done that way. And that's why you need to have really good data like this so they can guide it back to pretty much to near the location where you first discovered that. Yes?
Are those wild onions like traditional Navajo food?
Yeah. Most of the onions we use. See, where this one, it's where it's normally found in is what we call the Zuni Mountains. And Zuni Mountains wasn't called Zuni Mountains, you know. Navajos, we called it Ochin Tsil, which means Onion Mountain. Rainbow, we used to call it Ochin Tra, which means a place among the onions, you know. Mm-hmm. In 1849, when Herbie Simpson, Lieutenant Herbie Simpson, came through here with the John Washington, McCrae Washington expedition, he renamed a lot of the landforms in this area. He named the Zuni Mountains then, and he named the Mount Crater then. And he named like Hosta Butte and all the archaeological sites there at Chaco. So, next slide. Okay, here's my rewards. This is the reason why I'm really into collecting and studying plants now. This is a small plant that I discovered in 2000. The year 2000, I went out on the a place called Toto de Park. I was looking on the Owl Rock member of the Chin Lee Formation, which is the upper member of the Chin Lee. Anywhere throughout the Southwest, you'll find anywhere between 7 to 8 different members of the Chin Lee. The Chin Lee is probably one of the most interesting layers to study in terms of plants. Throughout the Southwest, there's probably over 380 endemics to just the Chin Lee Formation alone. And this is one that's an endemic to that Chin Lee Formation. So this one is a plant that I discovered in 2000, 2002, 2003. We went ahead and published it. Dwayne Atwood and Stan Welch from Brigham Young University, they're the ones that named this one for me. This one's called Alicella clifforda, Clifford's groundsel. So it's one that's named after me. So this is a disc flower only. Usually these Senecias will have a ray flower. And this is kind of unusual having no ray flowers. They're very short, probably about 2 inches off the ground. And so far it's only known from one location, from the tight location near Toto de Park, in an area probably like about 3 acres, 4 acres, and no more than 200 plants. So that's how rare this plant is. Next slide. The Navajo name for that group we call it is those Senecios that I just showed previously. And it's part of what we call our lifeway medicines. Here's one that I discovered on the same day, 2 hours later, in another location, same formation. I'll remember the Chin Lee Formation. This one was located about 4 miles, where the crystal turnoff is going to wheat fields and all that going down there, Windrock. So right at that junction, if you go to the west, right along the escarpment, there's like a little hog back there. Right along the rim of the escarpment, no more than 3 acres, no more than 200 plants there. So this one I named Areognum Sarahae. Sarah's wild buckwheat, and I named this one after my grandmother. Sarah was her name. Cheze is what we call this, you know, within this group. When I was growing up, when I was learning about plants, after a certain time frame, she started concentrating on certain groups, and one of the groups that she concentrated on was the buckwheats that we call Areognums. And Areognums, we probably have over 450 to 500 across the United States. James Reville, who was the North American authority, he passed away about a year ago. So right now, there's a big void left in this whole group of plants right now. There's nobody that can expertly and, you know, competently identify a lot of these new ones that are coming up. And I was really grateful to have met him, to have worked with him. I've described three new Areognums with him. And when I first met him, everybody was in awe of Reville. Reveal is like these botanical gods, you know. Yeah. There are people looking up to them with, you know, open eyes and open mouths and big eyes. And so when I met him, I said, you know, it was a real pleasure to meet him. And then I started, you know, just taking him out in the field, showing him different things, showing him this one. And it was neat because I started teaching him things. I started teaching him about Areognums. Here he was, the world's foremost leading authority in Areognums, had become a student again. At 70 years old, you know. And he was introduced into a whole new world of Areognums he never dreamed of. A whole new world of Areognums studies from Navajo side, you know. And he thoroughly enjoyed it. And he was just sitting there, like, every time I met him, he's like, man, what are you going to teach me today about buckwheats, you know? So it was really neat to have met him that way, you know. And so, you know, that's why you got to keep yourself humbleized. You know, especially if you become very good in some field of science. There's too many scientists that try to think above you, you know. They don't try to view people as humans, you know. And so with Reveal, you know, he humbleized himself that way. You know, when he realized that there's a whole lot of new learning out there. So this is one. This is the plant that started it all with him. So this is called Areognum Sarahae, buckwheat. Next slide. Here's one that I'm constantly studying every summer for about 25 years, maybe more. This is federally listed as a threatened. It occurs from south of Cortez, south of Toyot, and just north of Table Mesa, south of Shibots, the habitat, the range of it. It occurs on the Upper Manka Shale. It's federally listed as threatened. At one time, they were thinking about delisting it because they thought it was a lot more common than they originally thought. And during the 2000 years, 2001, 2002, 2003, 2004, we had 4 years of drought. And during that time, on one of those years, there's a whole bunch of army worms that are crawling around all over the place in November. You can see them on housing walls, in the streets. You can see them out in the desert, climbing over plants, on cactuses. And so the ones that were out in the desert, I think they were cold. And these individual cactus stems, they have a natural beetle that bores on the outer exterior shell of it. And it doesn't bore in too far, so it'll just enough to lay its egg, and then it'll leave its egg in there and take off again. So I think a lot of these worms, they found these boreholes, and then they start hollowing them out, eating them out, keeping warm, and also having a food source. So the following couple of years, I came back. All I saw were a bunch of clusters of spines, you know, like skeletal spine fragments. And I realized that there's probably 85 to 90% of the whole population died off. You know, there's an area where I found like 2,500 individuals. I came back, there's probably only 250 of them left. Another area I found 1,400, 100% mortality rate, not a single one left. So that made the U.S. Fish and Wildlife think, you know, saying that we shouldn't be listless. Now they're even considering elevating to endangered. So plants are really interesting how they react to their different ecological things that are thrown at them, weather, water, and so forth. So this is kind of a neat one that I've been studying for a number of years as well. Next slide. The Navajos, we call this a huashtuk oje, which means kind of like sour cactus. And like I said, the name of it is Sclerocactus Mesa Verde. Mesa Verde cactus is the common name. So this is the general area that I'm kind of talking about. Here's the Cruiza Mountains. Here's the Lucachique Mountains with Cove, Lucachique, all this red rock country in here. And here's the Chusca Mountain Range here, and there's a Shibok Peak there. So I'm going to start kind of talking about this area for now, right, just for a short period. Next slide. Okay, this is where I'm currently doing my work at. This is called Cove Mountain, Mexican Cry Mesa. And Cove is just to the north of here, and this is what they call the beautiful mountain, Anticline. There's a series of six canyons that I'm checking out in there. They're all super meandering, no trails, they're all overgrown, all rocky. Some you have to crawl over big boulders. There's a lot of dead and down trees all over, a lot of fresh ones from the past season, all kinds of hazards. But this is where there was a lot of mining that went on in the 1940s into the 50s and on into the 60s. Kerr McGee were doing mining in this whole region. And a number of years ago, in the 2000s, the Navajo tribe, they initiated a lawsuit against Kerr McGee. And so Kerr McGee was denying that, you know, there was nobody living back there during the time that they were mining. And so my uncle and I, we became expert witnesses for the U.S. attorneys from Washington, D.C. So we got visited numerous times, we got interviewed numerous times, and we took them out in the field numerous times. And in the end, we helped the Navajo tribe get like $44 million or something like that. And that's what we're using to do as part of the effort to clean up some of the other areas that didn't get around to during that first phase of uranium mine cleanup. And so my job was to look at the biological resources there. My first summer, I inventoried the whole geology, all the rock layers, all the stratigraphy, all the structural stuff. Then I inventoried all the rare plants. I inventoried all the rare animals. I inventoried all the community types and the springs and so forth. And then the second summer, they asked me to do all the raptors. And then I started studying the owls in that area. They asked me to look for Mexican spotted owls. And so these spotted owls, you know, they're different. They're small, and they're very cryptic. They live only in areas where, you know, it's the most difficult place that you can get to, way in the back recesses of these canyons. Sometimes you have to go like six miles of bushwhacking just to get to them. And a lot of times we've been not told the whole truth about owls, you know, because owls, you know, we tend to say yeah, but they bring bad messages. They're forebears of evil and things that are about having bad about to happen. It's not them themselves. It's these people, humans, that have bad heart, that have bad intentions of doing bad to you. They're the ones that send these certain types of species to deliver the messages. In their own, they won't do that. In the teachings of owls, it means they're night dwellers. And they go about at night. They go about re-beautifying the earth. They go about re-setting hajjan. They go about making the earth happy. They go about making all the animals happy and feeling related to each other. So that's what they do at night. And when they come home in the early mornings, the evidence of that is the result is when right before sunrise, you see all these birds here singing. They're all happy in the trees because the owls have did their work overnight, you know. And then a long time ago, we came up with an agreement with them. The holy people in the Nightway chant, Yebichija. They gave us four plants to use. One of them is Chichin, sumac. Wild sumac berry that everybody eats for porridge. That was a gift from the owls that was given to us. In return, we gave him four sacred tobaccos. Some are like ferns. They occur in cliff walls and overhangs where only owls can get to, you know. And then we receive from them their use of their down feathers. When you look at the mass of these Nightway chanters, you'll have like eagle feathers that stick out with down feathers at the base. And then you'll also, on the individual feather, we use those when we do cigarette offerings in the Nightway chant. You know, you make these cigarettes and you put your tobacco inside those corn husks, and you use the owl's quill as a temper to tamp it down while they're singing, while they're chanting. So that's how it's also used. So it's a different type of teaching. It's a different type of more beautiful teaching than just saying it's something that's to be avoided and dangerous, you know. So that's why I went ahead and studied these. Next slide. So this is my one of the canyon systems that I go into. Next slide. And see how narrow it gets? This area, actually, I was sitting here like 1 o'clock in the morning doing my calls. I do these surveys at night. I run across these black bears and mountain lions at night in there. Even them, you know, you got to take a different approach with them. In Navajo teaching, we have to set up relationships with them as a family. So while I'm walking up these canyons at night, I would say, "What they show, Charles Ashitui, no one husjan," you know. So like I'm talking is right now is a normal dialect, normal voice. But when I'm there, you have to throw out your voice. You project yourself to be more older. You project yourself to be more commanding. And when these bears and mountain lions, when they hear you, especially when you establish that relationship with them as Shitsui, my grandchild, my grandkids, you know, they'll understand. They'll come close and they'll come, they're curious, but they won't ever have contact with you. And then also you have to put katadine down for them, corn pollen. Put katadine in the water, put katadine on the side, you know. You bless the water as well. So this is what we do here. So one night I was sitting here in a place similar to this, and right up above me was a mountain lion. I didn't realize it. And so my colleague, when I was talking to my colleague, when she was taking notes, I looked up in my headlamp like this, and I saw it in her eyes. And you could see her eyes get... she didn't want to stay there no more. I heard my other colleagues were saying, let's go, you know. And I was going, well, let me do my call first. So we start walking back down, and it followed us for 3 miles. Like 300 feet behind us. At one point, we were stuck between that and the black bear in front of us. So I took out my black cats, you know. My first offense is my whistle. Then my next offense is black cats. And I said, man, I can grab my black cats. And so I started digging around. I didn't have my lighter. I said, no, what am I going to do now? So I said, I think I'd rather take on the bear, you know. So I just started walking down streams. And who I shot. And next thing you know, something went crashing out to the side of the... You know, and he's the black bear that got out of the way, you know. So interesting, every night we run different things like that. Next slide. Here's a alcove, one very neat alcove. There's an actual nest right up in here, if you can see that. Right here is where we ran across in one nest, 3 owlets. You know, I've talked to people from the Fish and Wildlife, I've talked to people that have done owl studies for years and years, like 25 years. He said, very, very rarely there's no more than one owl in a nest. Mm-hmm. Having 3 is unheard of, you know. Like I said, this is so remote. It's so remote that it allows the owls to do that. There's so much forage for them there. There's so much little mammals and little rodents and stuff. So they live in these protected areas. You have these huge alcoves. You have these old growth ponderosa pine, Douglas fir, and old growth oak shrubs that come on out from the bottom. And they're actually kind of like, you have real narrow flyway zones, literal narrow, like, entryways. And the reason why they pick these areas is because these areas provide a shelter from their predators. Long-eared owls, northern goshawks, crows, and, you know, like other types of raptors, you know, like eagles and stuff like that. So this is their prime habitat right here that they like to live in. Areas similar to this. Next slide. So that's a neat alcove that I took from the back recesses. So even here, it's kind of dangerous. You gotta watch out where all this rock falls at. You have this big old huge pile of boulders that build up in the middle of those alcoves. A lot of times, some of these alcoves are like from here to the main road over there, even up to Rio Procro, where they curve around that far, you know. So you're gonna be walking like this along that wall, like this, you know, because you have these big old piles that are preventing you from going this way, you know. Next slide. So there's coming out of one of them. And look right here, I don't know if you can see that. Some small figure. Next slide. There's my little buddy. Mm-hmm. All right, next slide. And there's his sister. This is after like 2 weeks after we were initially seeing them, when they were getting a little bit larger, they're starting to lose their down feathers, starting to barely starting to develop their primary feathers. Next slide. And can you go back 2 slides, Hirsch? All right, this one here, I tried, you know, taking all different angles. I was trying to get that word Willy out of there. But he just sat there and and so I said, I'm just going to call him Willy. So his name is Willy. He's a male. He sits off on his own. And I think what he was doing, he's trying to practice how to build his own nest there, you know. And he sits there because right down below is the water. And so he just sits there patiently all day long until like one of these small mice run on out and drink some water. And he'll jump down and grab it and have his meal, you know. See, I think that's the reason why they were so successful in raising 3 owlets there. Next slide. So that's Willie now. You know, after I've seen him get a little bit larger with his primary feathers, he has that distinctive reddish color in him. Next slide. And those are his sisters. They're still white. There's one here and one up there. So,
oh, there's one on top too.
Yeah. So, when you approach these studying plants, studying animals, the way I approach it is I approach it very reverently. I hold these in a high regard, and I talk to them. I kind of relate to them in terms of like my family. So in order for me to get up this close to them, I've been up to like that close to them, where she's sitting there. And what I do is I'll go down like this, you know, real close and say, yat-o, yat-o, you know, say yat-o, and then as soon as I get close, and I'll say, yat-o, yat-o, and give them a little bit of corn paw, you know. Then I start talking to them. I tell them, thanks for allowing me into your life, into your world for a short visit, and, you know, give me protection and stuff like that, you know, give me blessing. So that's what they respond to. One night I took my colleagues. This was when my colleague first saw these owls. And the week and a half before, I took the EPA in there, and some other scientists, and they weren't reverent about it. They're just kind of joking around. Owls. And when we sign it, we'll just go ahead and capture and fry it like fried chicken. They were saying, you know. So when we got there, there's no owls, you know. They didn't even want to see us. They were all hiding. And then the following week and a half, there's one of my, this one gal, she's trying to get some shadow hours so she can study, get her own permit to do her own studies. And so I let her tag along, work with me, and use her as my assistant. And so she was totally wholeheartedly, I mean, you could see it in her, just real enthusiastic. She really wanted to see one. She'd never seen one before, and she just kept talking about it. I really want to see one and all this. And so I told her, well, pray about it, you know, but tomorrow we'll see it, you know. And so we started up this canyon the next morning. And lo and behold, they were just waiting for us right there on the wash. Right off the wash, you know, just waiting for me to get there. And I started talking to them, and then she got close, and he got close. But they only got like maybe from here to that back wall, you know. But I got a little closer. And so they allowed us a small time frame. And by the time we took off, 2 bends around where he was at, it just totally started pouring on us. 5 hours of, I mean, 5 miles of heavy rain. And we're trying to get out of these narrow canyons before the flash flooding. The last mile of it was hail. So that's why I'm saying you have to respect these, because there's a lot of power in here, in these mountains, in the animals in here. And you have to have a real specific purpose to go in there with prayer and offering. Next slide. Here's Willie again. And so the following week, I took him up to the top where these individuals were at. And right at night, when it just became darkness and you could still barely see, I said, let's sit down right here. I bet they're gonna come by when I call them. So on the side of a mountain slope, there, under an old ponderosa pine, or pinyon pine, I start hooting at them. And all of a sudden, four of them showed up. One of them sat like 1 foot above me. I was kind of looking at it like this. And before it sat down, it kind of hit its tails on my cap like this, and then it bounced off and sat right here. And then the next one sat right here, 3 feet behind me on a branch. And then another about 10 feet on a tree over here. And then a small one about 10 feet away in the corner, about that far away.
Wow.
Just kind of dancing and hissing at us, you know. So it's neat, you know, because, you know, like I said, we have prayers and reverence for these. They'll show themselves up to you that way. Next slide. Here is two different pair that I found. Another different pair and another different canyon system. This one I got up very close to them as well.
Looks like a skeleton.
Yeah. I think they were nesting right up inside these overhangs here. Next slide. All right, other hazards. Waterfalls. And we have to build up little structures like this to get up on top. And even then, it's still very, very hazardous. Next slide. Quicksand, another hazard. Right where I had that last slide, there's rock falls too you gotta watch out for. And one time I was in there at night with my colleagues, I heard something pop on top of me. Right where she's sitting, all these boulders came in the darkness. That was scary, you know, so that's the kind of hazards I see down there too. Next slide. Here's another hazard, how it's really narrow. We have all kinds of critters hanging around in the shrubs like that, and a lot of ambush sites like that. Next slide. And a lot of fresh tracks. Everywhere we go, fresh tracks. Hmm. Next slide. And here's another one.
Oh, wow.
There's one that I found about 2 weeks ago that's probably at least 450 pound bear. So, a lot much larger than this one. All right, next slide. Next slide. And then we have, like I said, rock fall. I was here right before this happened. I was sitting there calling. I went upstream at night. I was like a mile up canyon. Next thing you know, I heard something crashing down. Came back by, and our whole rock wall had come down. You see, next slide. Go back. Next slide. Go back. So our whole rock wall came down. And on the other side, you'll see my pin flag sticking out right here. So if I was there, like maybe even 30 minutes more, it probably would have came down on me. Next slide. Now this one's interesting. I use this one as a lecture. I use this as an example. I took the students and the EPA out here to this site before it happened. I was talking about geological hazards of these canyons, of working in these canyons. Look at that fracture system. That joining system goes all the way down to the base of the washer. And I was saying there's probably a keystone here. If there's like some cow or some bear or flash flooding that rips through that, I said that whole wall has potential to come down. And I said we really need to watch out for these, especially if we're working back in here with equipment, with a lot of people walking around back there. Next slide. And then 2 months later, look what happened. The exact same area. Here's that big old tree that you saw. That whole wall came down. There's another huge section back here that's about to come down. The water still made its way through. Next slide. And then before that, we came back at night. The water was level, it was way up to here. And so I was up here at night looking down. I said, I'm not going to walk in that until it dries out. So we came back later and walked it out. But the last time I checked, the water level was up to here. So we found another way, going way up canyon, hiking back down into it. So that's the type of hazards that we run into as well. Next slide. Okay, let's talk about plants now. This is an image called the humpback god. And it's a powerful entity. A polymorphic entity. It's part human being, part desert bighorn, part Rocky Mountain bighorn, part holy people, part human being. It's horns. It's usually depicted dark blue. It has like a wedding basket that's been inverted, cut a hole cut through, and it's painted black. The horns, they represent a crown of weather, a crown of thunder, a crown of light, a crown of precipitation. So, as before it starts raining, you'll see all these dark bluish gray clouds coming over the horizon. And that's why the horns are colored that deep bluish color. And then on the basket itself that it wears, the basket is all black, painted black. There's a white zigzag line that goes around like this all the way around. And that represents nighttime between clouds when you have chain lightning, like lightning between different clouds. And that's what it represents there. And then on the very top of the baskets, it usually has a reddish woodpecker feathers or reddish red flicker feathers. And those represent like after a good shower, like the late afternoon, sometimes you'll have the clouds kind of open up and you'll have these real narrow sun rays coming down through the clouds. And that's what that represents on the top of its crown like that. It has a mask, and then it has this rainbow in the backside, this bow here. On top of the rainbow are attached either eagle feathers or red woodpecker feathers. They represent the early morning light, what we call Nihoka, during the time that we call Nihoka, when right like several hours before sunrise, when the whole surface of the ground appears to turn whitish, even though it's still dark. And during them times, you'll see these sun rays coming up over the horizon. And that's what these feathers represent there on the backside of that rainbow. And below the rainbow, inside that rainbow, is a dark sack. That sack has white bars on it with dark colors. And that also represents the dark clouds with all types of precipitation. It represents male rain, female rain, hail, sleet, snow, dew, any type of aerial precipitation that comes from the air. And inside that that bag are all these different types of plants, plant seeds, flowering plants, grass seeds and shrubs and trees and so forth. And so on the side here is depicted with this planting stick. Usually has a planting stick on the side. So during the coldest parts of winter, when you get extensive cover of fog, you get a large number of these humpback gods that come on out. And so they'll dance around the fog and shaking their backs like they're saying, "Awoo, awoo." And when they shake their backs, all these seeds fall out. And during that time, with their planting stick, they get the adults dance around like they're saying, pushing it into the ground like that. So during the springtime, early summer, throughout the summer, you get this whole new explosion of different types of flowering plants that come on out. So that's what the humpback gods are responsible for. Not only that, but the very core, the foundation, the core of the healing rites, the core of the prayers, the songs, and the majority of the sand paintings was given to us by the humpback god for the nightway chant, the 9-day, 9-night ceremonial that we call the Eibichi. And on the Saturday night in the evening, you'll see him come out with fringe god and talking god and humpback god. They all come out and bless the patient. And you'll see him walking out, woo, like that, making that noise. So they're very powerful entities. For domesticated plants like corn, beans, squash, tobacco, taji, turkey is responsible for that. And that also leads back to part of the nightway chant stories about Batahatini, the visionary, when he finishes his learning of the nightway chant. He decided to grow a farm, create a farm for produces that he's going to need for this chant that he was going to perform. And so he didn't have any seeds. And so the turkey came on out. The turkey brought them seeds out from Hajinne, from the emergence. When he ran back down to grab his bag, he came running back up and that water was lapping up against his tail, turning it white. So he brought out his seeds with him, like this, his bag of seeds. And he hid it in different parts of his body. And when he's dancing around, in front of his master, the visionary, the Kahatini, from the very tip of his white tail came white corn, From the very top of his tail, there's a yellow spot on the turkey that's kind of yellowish here. That's where yellow corn came from. From his striped feathers, tail feathers, that's where variegated corn came from. And then from under one side of his arms came watermelon, melons and stuff like that. The other side of his armpit came all the cantaloupes, you know, and zucchinis and stuff like that. And then from parts of his face, there's like the blue corn that came from there, part of the red corn came from there, and also tobacco as well. So with all the turkey represents all the domesticated plants, and then the humpback god represents all the native indigenous plants. And that's the difference between the two. Next slide. Okay, edible food. This is a plant called Calcordis aureus, golden mariposa. Navajos, we call this a chintan, which means a kid's food. So if you dig down about 4 or 5 feet below the ground there, where the ground level starts, you'll find these white bulbs at the very bottom along on the roots. Very shiny. And you can pick them out from the field, clean them, pop them in your mouth and eat them fresh without cooking them. They taste kind of like peanuts, a little bit sweet. And so that's why the younger kids used to pick that for their treats, and that's why they call that a chintan. A lot of times when we collect these plants and when we break them out at the base, we'll replant that into the ground. I'd also just end up even a small prayer, and that helps the plant to regrow in the same spot again, another new one. Next slide. This one is called Psammopteris bulbosa, plains biscuit root. It's in the umbo family or the carrot family. This is the Navajo name for this is Chash Ejilia. Means Chash Eji is like something that's kind of like attached to a root, like in a dark area, like underground. And if you dig like a foot or more below the plants there, about that far down, you'll find like a carrot. And it's all white on the inside. It's a lot more tastier than the store-bought carrot. And so we call this a Navajo carrot, is what we call that. And when you shave off the bark on the top of it, you get a lot of it, you can eat. The inside is edible, fresh. The outside bark, you can use that to produce like a light yellowish-brown dye for your wool as well. You can put your wool in there and it'll give you dye that way. And then these, once they mature, once the flowers mature, you'll get like some fruiting, winged fruits up on top. Those are edible right from the plant like that. I used to pick them and eat them like that. It's a kind of a medicinal taste, has a lot of medicinal values in them. Next slide. All right, this is Allium gudinii or Allium macropetalum. Common onion, chin. Meaning like grass, chin meaning kind of smelly, smelly grass. And if you're collecting food for onions, make sure right at the base where the green stem starts to come on out, or even the leaves, kind of rub that with your fingers and make sure it has that onion smell. If you don't have an onion smell, don't bother it. Because some of those that we have are called like, and those are poisonous, like death camps. So you don't want to eat those. Next slide. Here's a photo of Thelasperma megapodomecum is the name of that. That's a big old mouthful. Green leaf tea, Navajo tea. There's two different types. This is one with the disc flowers only. And then there's another one with what we call ray flowers. And these have like very, very skinny, narrow, filiform type of leaves. And more wiry. They grow in sandy areas, whereas the other one grows more in clay regions, pinyon juniper woodland, big yellow flowers. They're just as tasty as this variety here. So we use it as a kind of like a mild, relaxing tea, like for with either like for food, for snacks, or even just like sitting around and drinking tea like in the afternoon. And it's recommended too when you're sick, when you get like fevers. When you drink this tea, it'll alleviate your symptoms, like having body aches and stuff like that. Then also the color itself, you can also use that to produce a yellowish to orange yellowish dye for wool as well. It's also used as a dye plant. Next slide.
Did they, excuse me, did they say that it's good for diabetes too, if you drink the tea?
It has no sugars in it. And yeah. So there's a lot of these native plants that, so it has ephedrine, yeah. Ephedrine, it has a little bit of ephedrine in it. And A, it's kind of like a slight stimulant. Mm-hmm. It naturally peps you up, whereas you would have like a Coke or something to pep you up that way. So I would replace it for that. Here's one called Indian rice grass, Orizopsis hymenoides. The panicle here is used, the seeds here. A lot of the grass seeds, the grass plants that we have, like the goyetas, like the alkalis acetones, and like the wheat grasses, the majority of these grasses that we have out here are edible. And for this particular one, you would grab a whole handful like this and just kind of strip off the top. And you'll have a bunch of these little, I think they'll call it the rachis, the ones that hold up these little seeds here. And so what you do is you slowly peel back your hand like that. Every time you get exposed, you pull them out, then you pull it back until you get rid of most of it. And then you put it on like those old stone stoves. You burn it off. You burn off the rest of it. You kind of parch it. And then once you parch it, then you can get the seeds and ground and pound them. And then the pounded stuff, you put water in it. And then you can make like little chips or like crackers or cookies or like even like small bread. And that's what we use to eat for our fiber and our bread items. Next slide. Here's sumac, chin. The berries are used when they're right around this color, when they turn a deep red, deep maroonish purple color. You pick them, they're very sticky, then you dry them out. Then once they dry out, then you can grind them. And then when you grind them, you boil them, you reduce them, you make a porridge out of it, and then it's edible food from there. The stems on these, the branchlets, the stems, the branchlets, and the bark of the branchlets are also used for making basketry items, like baskets, because they're very flexible. The whole stem is flexible. And these are small branchlets, too. They're also used ceremoniously. A lot of ceremonial objects are made out of these branchlets. Like some of the Yeviche mass that we have, you'll see like the eagle feather sticking out straight up. The foundation for that, what holds it up are these forked juniper or sumac shrubs. Rus aromatica is what we call this, Rus aromatica. Variety trilobata. And those are the ones that occur along waterways like rivers and irrigation ditches and like streams. There's another variety that we call Rus aromatica, variety simplicifolia. It grows on slick rock, more drier sites, on like sandstone sites. But those also produce berries, and those are also used as a porridge food as well.
Are these related to poison sumac?
These are related to poison ivy. In the same family.
But the berries are edible.
Yeah, the berries are edible.
Mm-hmm.
The poison ivy, they're called a toxicodendron. So, same group. Next slide.
Are those wolf berries?
No. Those are sumac berries or skunkbush. So there's several common names. This one's called Opuntia fecantha. These are very difficult to work with, all the Opuntias. We have several different identified species, Opuntia fecantha, polycantha, and then the whole thing just kind of, it's all messed up. There's a number of glaciation that has happened in the past from the San Juan Mountains. The glaciation that was happening in the San Juan Mountains affected everything down here, even as far as down here. So during that time, a lot of the oak shrubs, a lot of the opuntias, they crossbred and they hybridized. So right now, it's very difficult to pinpoint a lot of these species as these plants as exact which species they are. So this one I've been kind of just calling it cancer for now. It produces like cream-colored flowers, pink-colored flowers, rose-colored flowers, and salmon-colored flowers. Sometimes all on the same plant. Wow. Right, next slide. So these are mature fruits of those. Mm-hmm. And the pads themselves, sometimes they're very thin, but once after the monsoons, they'll kind of like absorb water. They'll kind of like thicken up. During them times, the pads are edible. And you're talking about diabetes food. This is a good example. You use those and you slice them up. You got real thin slices. Mm-hmm. It has natural sugars in it. And that's probably one of the best ones that you can use. Mm-hmm. There's different species of this that are edible. It's kind of like it was used as emergency food in the past. The spines are singed off. And once they're singed off, then you kind of scrape them off. Then you can start slicing into thin slices. The fruits themselves, these fruiting capsules, there's these small white dots that are called glochid hairs, glochid spines. You don't want to handle them like right off the cactus with just your bare hands. Because each individual one, like one little dot, there's probably at least like 300 spines there. So I'd rather be poked by one of the larger ones than like 300 of those small ones that'll take you like a whole week just to keep picking it. And so there's a plant that I mentioned this genera earlier, called Senecio. Senecio, there's another species called Senecio douglasii, which we call Quashbeil Joha. And you'll find them along the roadsides, and they're kind of tall and yellow, with yellowish flowers and grayish foliage, real narrow foliage. And on the leaves and the stems, they have kind of like the hairs they call tomentum. So you get a bunch of that, you clump it up, and then you start rubbing them on the outside of these fruits. And what it does is it takes off all those little spines. And once you treat it that way, then you can handle it with bare hands. Cut them up, they're edible, fresh. They kind of taste like, I don't know, like kiwi, strawberry type of taste to it.
They're prickly pears, aren't they?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And they're very, very gelatinous, very sticky on the inside.
Strider Brown, would collect, he would have these tables, full of them that he was processing every fall, making jelly and all sorts of really neat foods. He'd come over to my house and harvest all of mine too.
Yeah, the individual fruiting capsules, what you can do too is you can smash them into a pulp and you put it into like a container. You put water in there and mix it up real good. And after like a day or two, you put in your wool and you just let it sit there like for 2 weeks, week and a half, 2 weeks. Depending on how long of a time you put it in there, it turns your wool anywhere between a pink rose color to like a deep red color. So that's another dye plant that we have. Next slide. Echinocereus, Trilochidiatus, hedgehog. The fruits on these are also edible. Once they mature, the fruiting capsules, they're quite tasty. There's one we have in the Western Reservation with multiple stems and a little bit more of an orange-colored flower. Those aren't edible. Something that twists your heart. So don't eat those. next slide. Here's the up-close shot of the flowers. Bright red. Bright red flowers like that. Next slide. Here's a plant that we call Sclerocactus parviflorus. Fishhook cactus. The Navajo name for this is gapiji. And these are also edible emergency food. You can singe off the spines and slice them up like little pineapples. You can cook them and eat them. So those are also edible as well. Next slide. Jada. Next slide. They bring rain. Okay. Let's go a little bit into protection plants, going into our medicinal ceremonial section of this slideshow. These are our plants, our grass that we call Hilaria jamesii, galleta grass. Next slide. This is Ceratoides lanata, winter fat. Katsotan means big jackrabbit food. Next slide. And Tililiasi, Gutaregia sorosteri, broom snakeweed. All these three, including there's like two others that we use, we'll get all like four or five plants together and we'll burn them, produce ash out of them. The ash that's produced out of that is used for blackening rites. Like if you have like a new home or new dwellings or new building blessings, they'll put these like ash on your doorways and your pane, window panes and so forth, different parts of your home, of your building, for protection and also for blessing. And individually, people will put it on their foreheads, put it on parts of their body for protection and for their own personal blessings. So this is used that way, these set of plants for external protection. The broom snakeweed is kind of interesting because it's a multi-use plant as well. You can get a yellow dye off the flowers, and also this is also a jade, and it's also used as a heart medication as well. That's how we use that. Next slide. Okay, there's protection plants. I talked about Eriogams, buckwheats. There's a whole lot of different Eriogams out there. These are all annuals. A lot of your annuals don't have like really large leaves. There's all these branching flowering ends. So this one's called Eriogam weatherlilii, named after the weatherals. It occurs around the Four Corners area, out towards Monument Valley, towards Navajo Mountain, southern, southeastern Utah. And it's used as a protection plant. So it's something that's protecting against evil way. And you pulverize it, you get a whole bunch of it, you crush it, you put it, keep it on your cell. Like the way we have like corn pollen, the way we have like cheat. And whenever we go into the public, like rodeos or gatherings or like powwows or dances, we would take a small amount of it and you rub it on yourself, on your body, on your head, and on your mouth, and you put it on yourself for blessing yourself, for pre-protection. And it's a protection against people that have evil thought, that want to do harm against you, and you know, and so forth. Because whenever there's like something bad that's coming at you, in terms of looking at this plant, by the time it hits you, look at all these different pathways before it gets to you at the bottom. So by the time it gets to your central core bottom, it's all been dissipated. The effect has gone away. And that's the reason why we used to use this. Not a whole lot. My family was probably the only one that knew how to use this one. So there are certain family plants that only certain certain families have knowledge about. And this is one of the ones that my family had.
Can you repeat that name, please?
Eriogam weatherill. Eriogam. Yeah, weatherill. Eriogonum. Eriogonum. Eri meaning what? Old. Ogonum is like knees or like woolly knees. So, next slide. Here's one. This is a ceremonial plant. This is called Hymenoxys acalus variety Ibestiana. So this is a woolly base, is the common name, woolly base. If you look at the base of the plant, there are kind of like woolly white hairs on them. And the Navajo name for this one is Ayanabatsi, which means buffalo hairs. And it's used as when you gather them up, you dry them out, you have like a bunch of coals, you will put it on your coal, and you fumigate yourself, this way with prayers. Once the medicinal plants were in place, once the medicinal plants were categorized into a unit, the holy buffalo people were placed in charge of overseeing these medicinal plants. And that's why this plant was given to them as a way to bless that and as a way to pray with that. Next slide. Mm. Now, this is a medicinal plant here. Another Eriogonum. It takes 2 years for this plant to complete its growth cycle. I talked about how you take the upper part of the plant and you place that basal leaves or like fragments of plants back into the same place where you found it in a small hole. Something else will come out, growing out of there again. Here's a good example. Here's something that was taken and replaced and then it regrew back. So this is from an old stem. This is the first year of growth. It produces these basil flowers, basil roses. It'll overwinter. The second winter, second summer, it'll produce the basil roses again. And then it produces a flowering stalk. It'll flower, seed out, and then 2 years of it slapping, it's over. So this is a plant that's called Areogram alatum. Wing buckwheat is the common name, wing buckwheat. The Navajo name for this one is Xe'eze, which means ground medicine. Xe'e means ground, Eze means medicine. And we use the roots of it. The roots are kind of like a slender taproot. The larger the basil rosette, the larger the root. And once you collect the roots, what we do is we strip it longitudinally, lengthwise, and then you break them up this way. You have a big old bundle like that, all stripped roots. And what you do is you put a little bit of roots like that into like a container, like a glass jar for water. Well, at first you heat it up first. And then right before it starts to boil, you turn it off. And you just let it simmer. You leave the roots in there. You let the whole thing get cold and you put it in the refrigerator. And every day you drink that, maybe 10, 12 ounces of it. Especially, it's used for if you have any type of backaches, any types of broken bones, any types of surgery that you've had, it'll help you to heal a lot quicker. It'll help you to reset your bones a lot quicker. And so this is how this plant works. It's kind of like a painkiller too. It's all part of what we call the lifeway medicines. Inaja is the. And the story that goes along with that is the Inaja is long ago, like Navajos, we have maybe upwards to 500 deities, you know, different types of gods and deities. And one is called Anitso, Big Thunder. Another is called Rain Boy. The story goes between the two, between Rain Boy and Big Thunder. Big Thunder, or Rain Boy, was caught. He committed adultery with Big Thunder's wife. So Big Thunder got mad and he struck down Rain Boy with lightning. So Rain Boy's body was dismembered. It went all over the countryside or throughout the world, this whole region. And so the holy people said, we need Rain Boy for the production of rain, or to start raining real good. And so they decided to have the restoration rite of Rain Boy. And all the early holy people and the early animals, birds, because we could communicate with them all at that, during that time, were able to still communicate with them. They were instructed to pick up all the body parts wherever it was found. And within each body part, the groups of plants that grew around it, they were also instructed to collect these plants that was around these like the heart, the liver, the spleen, and so forth, the lungs. And so when they brought all these parts back to one centralized location, they did a restoration rite. They started applying these plants that they found near the heart. They started applying these plants that they found near the liver. And these body parts, they start regenerating life. They start coming back to life. So when they were put back together, you know, these plants that were used, these plants that were collected near these body parts, those are the ones that became our lifeway medicine. And Naja is the Labadina. Lifeway medicines, because they gave life back to Rain Boy. It's very interesting because I study war religions too, world cultures. And this exact same story shows up in the restoration rite of Osiris, you know, in the Book of the Dead. And it's also about love. You know, Osiris was dismembered by Seth. And they had a restoration rite for Osiris when they brought him back together. Before Osiris was restored full life, before Rain Boy was restored full life, one body part they had to replace in both characters. And in each case, this part of your lip, this little indentation, when it was replaced back to Rain Boy, when it was replaced back to Osiris, they were both given life back. So life was restored among them. And later on, 20th century, when veterinarians were studying like animals when they pass on, like cows and horses, they would temporarily shock this portion of the lip. And when they give it an electrical shock, that horse and that cow would temporarily come back to life. So, you know, it's really neat seeing the parallelism between some of our stories and how some of that shows up in other parts of the world, you know. So that's how this knowledge of medicine was given to us, is through that restoration rite of Rain Boy. Next slide. Here's the flowering portion of that Ariagnama lady, the winged buckwheat. Here's the fooding portion. See these little appendages? These are like little wings, and that's where the name comes from. Next slide. There's after 2 years of growth, that's an old dead one. Next slide. Here's one that, if you can't find that Ariagnama at a lower elevation, then you can go up to around the Ponderosa Pine Forest Zone and find this different buckwheat there. This is called Ariagnama racemosum red root buckwheat. Also used in the same fashion, you use the roots, and it's good for back pains and back aches and so forth. Next slide. Yes.
Is that related to the mullein, to M-U-L-L-E-I-N, and is it in the mullein family or mullein?
Mullein, no, it's in a different family.
Okay.
I'll get to the mullein after a while. This one is a plant called Asclepias, Aspergillus, spider meltweed. The Navajo name for this is Ixcoa, something that makes you throw up, or Tetzoje, which means yellowish medicine. These plants are collected, we bring them to like almost a boil, and then we let it simmer. You drink it, you take it internally, and it cleanses you out your whole system. It'll make you throw up and do all kinds of stuff. And the reason why is...
I had one growing on my front yard for years.
And yeah.
It's a real perennial.
Yeah, yeah, they're really nice showy plants. And you get to a point where you get rid of all that yellow bile in your stomach. And when you get that rid of if you don't get rid of that yellow bile in your stomach, that's what causes cancer. That's what causes ulcer. That's what causes all this internal stomach types of problems. And that was the way we could alleviate that. Asclepius, the name Asclepius, is the Greek god of medicine. And the Greeks also use this. Right now, there's some research going on with Louisiana State University and also Fort Lewis College and some other institutions. They're studying the milky sap of these plants, these cardinalized, and they think there's some anti-tumor, antibacterial agent in them. So we also used to use them at Neville when you get warts. You'll kind of rub it all over your warts, you know, that milky sap. Over time, it eats it away. They say warts is like the initial stages of tumors as well. And so that's why we use the splint. Next slide. That's Carina pineda, that's Carina Sophia. Mustard family, tansy mustard. The pods on these very narrow pods are, when they dry out, they have these reddish-brown seeds in them. And when they open up, we spin them up and you can just dump them out. It's a whole bunch of, like, hundreds of seeds. And you pulverize all that, grind it up. It's for ladies. It's my grandmother, she used to harvest a lot of this, and all these ladies used to come by her place and they'll kind of visit and take out her pouch and they'll sit there and, like ladies snuff, you know. Clean out their nasal, and, you know. So that's how that was used there. All right, next slide. All right, this is called Macaranthera canescens. Hoary acid is the name of this one. The Navajo name for this is anesthazet, which means acne, pimple medication. So when you dry out this plant, you pulverize the stems and part of the flowers. They're kind of sticky, glandular. And when you dry them out, when you wash your face, you'll put a little bit of this stuff on it, you know, like with a dabber. And wherever you have acne or pimples, you keep doing that. And they say it stings a little bit. It absorbs all that oil. And over time, it gets rid of all your pimples and your acne. So that's how we use that for our native youth, Navajo youth. Next slide.
Is that also called a purple aster?
Yeah, purple aster is another common name. It's very common.
And what did you call them? I'm sorry.
They call them hoary aster, purple aster, purple macaranthras. That's the thing about common names. Like certain plants might have like 5 to 10 common names. And that's why I kind of throw out the scientific names, because there's only one or two. All right, this is in the a plant called Orobanche ludoviciana. Broom rape, cancer rape is the common names. The Navajos, we call it Azetbichichi, which means reddish street medicine on the inside. It's kind of used like for blood disorders, as a drink. Next slide. And then here's Pedicularis centrinthera. You'll find this under ponderosa pine. You'll find this under pinyon pine, woodlands. You'll find this under oak shrubs. Pinyon juniper lousewort. And the Navajo name for this is azoz, but is it? I mean, your arteries is called, we call it azoz. So this is a heart medication for strengthening up your heart. And that's how we use the roots of this plant to do that. That's how it's used. Next slide. Sporousias. We have probably about 9 different species of sporousia throughout the Southwest. Maybe 12 of them at the most. They all have orange flowers, and they're kind of difficult to figure out exactly what species they are until you recognize their leaf structure and also their geographical distribution. And then ultimately their patterns, what they call reticulation patterns on their fruits, on their seeds. And on the stems and leaves, there's a, they call peltate hairs. You can rub them off, they're kind of grayish. If you put water on it, it becomes really jello, gelatinous, kind of sticky. Because of that, we use it for like stomach disorder, like for stomach aches or internal disorders. And also they said you use it to like you wash your hair to prevent like hair loss, you know? So that's another way that it's used. Next
Arnold,
slide.
Arnold, there's that flower that's purple, but it's the same plant in the western side of the reservation.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the same species or is it different?
It's different. The purple ones, sometimes they're real common. I think those are called a scorpion weed. And I have a photo, you might recognize it here.
Is that also commonly known as globe mallow?
These are commonly known as globe mallow.
Okay.
You know, the name globe mallow is, they're buds. Right before they flower out, they look like little buds, kind of circular buds. They look like little globes. And in the past, they used to gather up a whole bunch of that before they flowered out. And then they would cook it. And they'll turn into like a little thick broth. And then they'll let it simmer and they'll let it reduce itself and get rid of all the water. And once it gets real sticky, that was the early form of marshmallows. And that's where the name comes from, mallows, you know. So it has that property. This is what can happen on a good year. One year we got like 3 square miles of this orange, you know. So sometimes they get even larger than this. So one year we had a whole bunch of orange like this, and every once in a while you'll see like taller flowering yellow flowered astanlias, those princess plume. So the whole effect was real neat looking at it across the desert. It's like you had this whole like layer like coals, ember, and then above the embers you had these yellow flames dancing, you know. That was neat, you know. Next slide. All right, here's the one that you might have. This is not it.
That
azetini,
but it has purple flowers, the
globes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all the ones that I've seen are orange flowered. That's probably might be interesting. You can take a photo. I don't know, maybe give me a photo text or something.
I've seen white globe mallow too.
Yeah, I've seen white globe mallows. Some of these are like on astragalus on some of the globe mallows. I'll walk around and like on good, very good years where you have thousands that come on out at once. And I figure like on this one plant called Astragalus mellissimus, for every 8,000 purple flower plants, there's an albino. And then there's like Astragalus italianum, for every 100,000 Astragalus purple italianum, there's a white one again.
Okay.
So every once in a while I'll do that if I get the opportunity. So these are called scorpion weeds, Phacelia cranulata. And this is one group that needs a lot of work. Dwayne Atwood, he was from BYU. I used to do a lot of work with him from there. In the past 15 years, we described maybe 15 new ones, just from this group alone. Azetinchinilia, smelly medicine. And they tell you not to handle it because the whole plant has sticky glands on them. if you have like a cut in your fingers or like a sore or if your hands are very sensitive, your skin is sensitive, if you handle these, they'll give you sores. But if you have like a sore that doesn't heal, like, if you prepare this species the correct way, it can also take away them sores too. Next slide. Here's one that you find in the sand dunes called Phacelia integrifolia. These two are very common. This is the first slide I showed you. Next one. This is a new one that I'm working on from Rhema. So this one I haven't given a name to, so I'm still trying to figure out what to call this one. Next slide. Here's another new one. This one, Dwayne Atwood, before he got sick, he named this one for me. He named this one Phacelia cliffordi. Clifford's scorpion weed. Mm-hmm. I recognize it as a new species in me as soon as I found it. It's found only in north of Dilcon, halfway between Dilcon and Tisto. There's some weird geological formations out there where I discovered this one. So, next slide. Okay, next slide. Okay, ceremonial plants. This is a plant called Datura. Datura ridei, Datura regalii. Sacred Datura, Jimson weed. It comes by different common names. It means something that you should be very wary of, something that you should try at all costs to avoid handling. It's a hallucinogenic. Every part of this plant is hallucinogenic. Even if you, like, some people, I don't know if they make the mistake of seeing these along the roadsides, like towards Bluff. They produce these real neat trumpet flowers about that big. So I've seen tourists go over there and go, trying to smell the flowers, you know.
Yeah.
And if there's pollen on there, there's potentially going to get you high, you know. And so, like I said, it's a very powerful plant.
That's
something else.
Is that
so
poisonous?
It's toxic, but back in the 60s, the hippies, they used to use it for getting high off. Some people, they'll get high off and they'll get be high for 4 days. And once they come off, they might be blind for another 2 to 4 days again. And then some people, they never come off of it because they don't know how much it's safe. And then some people never get off their blindness too. So it's a very dangerous plant. It was, I kind of learned about it the hard way, you know. I was in Utah one time, I hiked up these canyons about 8 miles in, and I saw a bunch of them on the canyon floor near some alcoves. I said, wow, look, this is different. So what I did is I started collecting them. I had like a little cut here and it's all going like this, and it's real hard to break the stems, it's real fibrous. So I collected like 9 different specimens, you know. Then I put them in my bag and I start walking back, and then I start feeling kind of weird. I'm kind of starting to not really hallucinate, but almost like it was affecting me. I was wondering why I was feeling kind of woozy walking all the way back, and I realized it was that plant. Then I got back in my truck and I sat there for 2 hours drinking ice water, trying to recover. And then I got home and I told my grandmother about it, then she got after me. So this is what it's called, and you know, it's supposed to handle it. But it's used ceremoniously. It's used to.
Family?
What's that?
Is it in the peyote family?
No, it's in the. It's kind of like a. What do you call it? It's in the nightshade family.
Belladonna.
Yeah. And so. It's used with other plants. It's used with a certain type of clay to alleviate that, you know, the uncontrollable high or whatever. And when they use it, they try to revisit the past. And they try to regain knowledge through it, like some old rituals, some old songs, some old prayers. They visit the past to vision quest back that way, and then they bring it back to use today. And then other ways that they use it was they used to use it like if somebody was mortally wounded, like real badly wounded, like if they were in real deep pain, without it, they would eat it as a painkiller. And then, you know, some people, they found the bad side of it too. And they, in the hagal, during like ceremonies, like some of these older men, they used to use it to entice these younger ladies and like a date rape drug. Without actually in there. So it's used multiple ways. And they chuckle, jibaha negi, nahuish bi, how chuckle was that the people were defeated. This was the big game, the secret to defeating all the people there. So without actually was in the other. And Zabaha Neti, there's a real long extensive story related to that one. Next slide.
What did you call it at the beginning? The Belagana
Neti. The Tura.
No, the...
Jimson weed?
Yes.
Jimson weed or sacred datura?
Sacred datura is where
I read. Yeah. Next slide. Okay, this is a bracken fern. Deshtan aquilinum, pteridium aquilinum. This is used as a, like for stuffing material. It's also used for... like fumigants, like for prayers. You get it dried out and put it in the coal and you bless yourself with it. And then also you use it like in tachche, you're gonna have like a padding to sit on, you get a bunch of it and you can sit on it. And then when they're that small, they're edible. When the fronds are still tightly coiled, you can eat them. But once they start to uncoil like that, they become poisonous. So they're edible when they're small, like that, without they done it. But in the Chisco Mountains, it represents a mountain that's totally out of bounds because of all the past logging activities. When the forest is natural, you had this natural cover of forbs and grasses, and you had the natural shade that the trees provided. So when you cut down these trees and put like bulldozers through there, chaining the rest of the shrubs and whatnot, it opens up the forest. It stirs up the ground. It gets rid of all the old seeds there. And then what it does, it provides more sunlight. So that sunlight encourages all the bracken fern to grow. So when you get up at Buffalo Pass and get up towards Look at the Great Mountain, it's totally covered on the forest floor. And that's indicating that the forest is out of bounds. Yes.
Oh, so that's what I was going to ask is, so then before the logging activities, it was more in balance and you wouldn't see the tightly coiled...
It wasn't quite as extensive in cover. Like it was in the forest, but you'll have like one plant, maybe like two plants for every acre or something.
Oh.
Instead of having like 200 plants per acre.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Next slide. All right, this is a plant called Erigeron. Erigeron bistiensis, bisti fleabane. This is a plant called Navajo name. We call this Azed Na'ol Tadi. It's using the shooting way chant. And there's a certain rite when they have a coil around it like this. And during that certain rite, when they're singing, the medicine man will start chewing this plant. Then every once in a while, he'll kind of spit on that portion of it. Na'ol Tadi, while he's unwinding. And at the end, when he unwinds it like this, that whole cord will come out and he'll toss it. So that cord represents, like this portion represents you as a person. That cord represents all your troubles, all the bad stuff that's around you. And so when he unwinds it and then he tosses it, all that trouble is supposed to leave your body. Next slide. And then this one's called Tamzendia and Cana. Small Tamzendia or Silver Tamzendia. Alchin Dan, yeah, or Alchin Sane means mini kids. And all these white flowerings are like, here's a parent plant in the middle. All the white flowers are the little kids, their offsprings. So they used to make tea for young ladies and young Navajo girls made out of this, just so they could have large families and produce large families. So I don't know, it's still practice. Next slide. Here's our pale wolf berries, Lycium pallidum, which means food of the holy people. And it's using the nightway chant. On the fourth night, I believe they have an all traditional feast that they have after the sing. And they make a porridge out of this, like the way we make sumac berries, like chin. We'll get the berries, pound them, and then we'll add clash to it, this kaolinite. And that mixture is what we use as a food that we call a. So that's an edible food that we have. Pale wolf berries, the common name. Next slide. Otto, here's another rose. This is called Rosa woodsii, woods rose. Another name for this is called chon. And it's used also in the shooting way chant. These branches or branches, they have thorns on them. So what they do is they create these hoops out of them. These hoops, several different hoops. And during a ritual, that hoop, they would put the patient would wear like a blanket over them. And while they're singing and chanting, they would walk through that hoop like this. Somewhere along that travel, those thorns will get a hold of that blanket. It'll pull it off that person, and that person will walk out of that hoop without that blanket. The same analogy as that's described on the string is when you leave that hoop without your blanket, you leave all your troubles behind. And that's another way that's being used. Next slide. This is willows, coyote willow, Salix exigua. Kite is the generic name for willows. We have a lot of different ones. So we have different ones. For the most part, we'll take small sections like this. And those will be used to make ketans, prayer sticks. Small prayer sticks like in the Nut Way chant. Then also willows, including aspens, on the inside of their bark, they have a little chemical substance that they call salic acid. And that's what aspirin is made out of. So if you have if you're in the wilderness and you get injured, you get sick, you get a fever. If you're in a ponderosa pine, then peel off some bark, eat the inside of the bark. Peel off some willows, eat the inside of the willow. It's a temporary aspirin, temporary pain reliever. And that's how it's used as well. A lot of other uses as well for the willows, and baskets and so forth. Next slide. Here's a plant called Cercium shayensis. This one's endemic to the Chusco Mountains. Caney, the shay thistle. Another one over, this is Zehokani. And these are used in the nightly chant, the ceremonial plants. And one of the things that's good to point out to people too is you see this portion between that leaf and that leaf, that leaf and that leaf, you know, there's that stem. Mm-hmm. See how smooth it is? It's naked. That's how the majority of your native thistles will look. If you have thorns that occur all the way from the leaf to the next leaf along the stems, thorns throughout the whole plant, then those are non-native, the noxious weed ones. So, yeah, like bull thistle and musk thistle and so forth, scotch thistle. Next slide. Yes?
Is that plant also used for to help the... liver,
like milk thistle?
Yeah, milk thistle.
I think that was a little bit different. It has, they're not quite as thorny. It has a milky sap in them. And they're similar to thistles, but they're a little bit slightly different group. Yeah. They're called Sanchez de Canadi. Oh. So, but I don't have a slide of that one.
So it's not that.
No, not that one, yeah.
Yeah, because there's a lot that are growing around our road.
the majority of those might be like non-native thistles, you know. The ones that were brought in from Europe. Uh-huh. Usually, you just get a whole bunch of them like in one area. Yeah, that's usually what it is. It's something that's not native. Yeah, well, maybe we'll figure out a way where you folks can take photos of some of the plants that you're interested in, and you can post them on my text photo or something, you know. Mm-hmm. And we'll figure it out, or my email. All right, next slide. This is Angel Peak here. Okay, tobacco is not. Oh, this one's called Aliciella haydeni, Delia haydeni, Hajonjanat. Oh, the beetleway smoke. Next slide. And then this one I discovered. In 2000, it took me 10 years to convince the North American authority that this was a new species. And so once I convinced him, I took him out into the field and he said, oh, that's a new one. So when he described it, he named this one Aliciella cliffordi. So this is a Clifford's Nestar or Clifford's Delia. And I like to call it Clifford's Hajonjanat. So it's a beautiful smoke. We use the basil leaves, part of the stems and part of the flowers, mix it in with the beautiful mixture. The beautiful mixture is a mixture that can comprise anywhere between 4 to 24 different plants. Without this. And tobaccos are different. We use them reverently. We use them during prayers, during ceremonial settings, during sweat lodges, during meditation, and during pilgrimages that we make. And we use it with tzedzin. And what it does, it's intended to reset your mind, reset your thinking. So it's like a restart button for people when they go through these tobacco ceremonies. They come out of it all kinds of their thinking. Next slide. So there's mullein, mm-hmm. One you were asking about earlier. We're basking Thaspis. Navajos, we call this a Nat Ohtso, big tobacco. Next slide. Those are the leaves. Next slide. Oh, you'll go back one previous slide. All right, these are the leaves here of mullein. See how they're very woolly haired? There's real short hairs on them. This plant has antihistamine properties. And so we use it as part of our tobacco mixture. Because if you smoke mountain tobacco, Nicotiana attenuated, a true tobacco, it's not, on its own, it's very powerful. It'll make you cough, it's a powerful smoke. So when you mix it up with mullein, we also mix it up with what we call purple sage, which is atzaze, poliomyntha and cana. The poliomyntha atzaze is what gives it flavor because it's in the mint family. When you go like this at the stems and leaves, it has that minty smell to it. So you use that, the mountain tobacco, hajonje, not oh, the beautiful tobacco, and this one. And then sometimes you'll use like kanik. Sometimes you'll use eriogonums. So all together, this thing here, it helps it to keep you from coughing. So if you have like bronchitis or asthma, you can actually roll a cigarette of nothing but this plant, and it'll help you alleviate your problems with your lungs, with your breathing. And also you can boil it too. You boil the leaves, and once it boils off, you can get like a cheesecloth and put it over like your cup. And you pour that and the liquid into your cup. You drink that and it'll get rid of all your asthma, bronchitis as well. So it's an antihistamine. Next slide.
Is that plant also used to protect the sheep because of the way the leaves are shaped and the sheep's ears?
Well, the sheep protection, yay. In the early spring or even the early summer, whenever you're going to let your sheep out into the rangeland, or you're going to take your sheep from the low country into the mountains, you go into the mountains first and you collect all the different plants that are there, all the shrubs, all the flowering plants, all the grasses, even the trees. And you bring back a big bundle like this, of all the different plants. And then part of that, you take part of a small portion, a little small fragment from each one. And then you boil it a little bit, but you don't really boil it. You just let it come, just let it heat up, and then you simmer it. You let it cool out, put that off to the side. The rest of it, you put into some type of structure or container where you can burn it. And then you put your sheep into like an enclosed area, like under one of those canopies. No. And then you put that smoking contraption in there. And then you just totally smoke out your sheep. They'll be coughing and wheezing and choking, and they'll be like snots coming out of their mouth, nose, and And the reason why you do that is we clean them out. And what happens is what we call bots and other like parasites. They'll get inside the nasal portion of the sheep, out into their down into their esophagus. Into their nasal area, and those parasites they keep your sheep from getting fat. They feed off your sheep internally, and by doing that, you cleanse them out that way. You'll see all these bots and whatever coming out of them, you know. And so after they're done, you would take some of that plants that you boil, and then each sheep you would grab and you would put a little bit into their mouth. And so ceremoniously, you're introducing the sheep to these plants that are out there. So when you let them out into the mountains, subconsciously, metaphysically, they'll already know which ones are the poisonous ones. They'll already know which ones are the bad ones to stay away from, you know. By doing that ceremony, it introduces it to them that way. You got any genius with this? So you can do that way too. Here's another tobacco, Eriogonum ovalifolium, cushion buckwheat. So these are tobacco mixtures, but not oil, something to bulk up your tobacco. Next slide.
Arnold, do they call mullein bijah too, or is that?
Bijah is a different one. Different one. It's the one called swerdia. It looks very similar, but it has very green, shiny leaves. There's no hairs on those. next slide. Okay, God, juniper. God is, we have several different species, and God is just a generic name. We have like, God in Egi, God in Nini. The berries are used for edible food, emergency food. And once the berries dry out, once you look below the tree, you'll find these like little berries, and some people make like ghost beads out of them for protection against bad dreams and so forth. Although the stems on these, see how they're imbricated? That's how we got our idea to finish off our Navajo baskets. Our Navajo baskets, they're different than like other Hopi Pueblo baskets. Like that, you know. And that's where that idea came from the invocation of that. And the bark is used. Bark is used in the filling material. We can use it as tobacco. When we were younger kids, we used to roll corn husks with a G. And we try to smoke with the old man, and man, makes us cough. Get in trouble for that too.
Can you use that also when it dries up? You burn it and then use it in your blue corn?
When you burn it, you can use it green, and then you burn the branchlets and the branch and the outer scales.
Mm-hmm.
See how this one has kind of real light yellowish tips on some of them?
Mm-hmm.
So on these, they're mainly green. If they're green and yellow, then you don't bother with the one, just eat it. You wait until the very tips of these juniper trees turn brownish to a reddish brown. When they're mature, you can use them then. We mix them in with our corn foods.
Yeah.
And also, because it has like tannins in it, tannin acid. So in the past, we had more of a hunter, like meat diet. And I'd say, you date down. So if your diet is predominantly meat, you tend to get ulcers, or not ulcers, but
indigestion or something.
No, it's like scurvy.
Oh, okay.
And so having those, having to burn juniper in our food, that's what prevent that onset of scurvies. But I thought you caught another one there. Next slide. Pinyon pine, Pinus edulis, chaos. So when it's green, we call it chakwal. When it's all dried, dead, and we turn it to wood, and even on the cut, when it's green, we call it cut. And when it's dried, dead, and he's a firewood. Oh, you know, like the bark, it's what we call the bark. And so this is a multi-use plant as well. The sap on these are antiseptic, antibacterial. So we use them for open cuts, open wounds. Building material, so using a lot of different ways. Next slide. There's one that's about to produce its cones, flower. Next slide. Yuccas, we have all kinds of yuccas. Tsas is the common name for yucca. This is yucca bacata, tsas and tail. And the narrow one is yucca angustissima, yucca balei, yucca harminiae. And yucca topii are the ones that we have. And multi-use plant, everything is used. These little fibers along the edge, you can break it off right here on certain species, and then you strip it off, you have an automatic needle and thread. And then you boil, you get these individual modified leaves, you boil them, and once you boil them, you can kind of pound them a little bit and they're easy to strip. The fibers that you get into them, you can start rolling them and making like little strings and eventually you can make ropes out of them as well. This particular one, Bacara, there was an old deity that was called Red God. They no longer practice that in the Nightway chant. That Red God, they used to be racing gods, and they used to wear these whole yucca plant with the flower hanging down their backs. Mm-hmm. And they used to have these yucca ropes and whips. So whenever you race them, and if they beat you in a race, you got to stand there for them, then they'll whip you with their yucca whips. But if you have like a back ache, or if you have an ache in your shoulders or somewhere over your leg, you'll go to, this is them, tell them to whip it right here. And when they whip you, that's kind of a healing right too. So that was used in the past. And
We have a plant like that that's growing in the front of our yard, and mm-hmm. it's got flowers.
Yeah.
There's about, four or five of them.
Wow.
So after it grows, the flowers, they form into kind of like a,
mm-hmm.
A pear.
Yeah, I have slides on that one.
Oh, okay.
Next slide. So here's Yucca angustissima. So these are the ones that we prefer to wash your hair with on the roots.
Yeah.
When you shave them, they're really white. The roots has a chemical substance called saponins. And that saponin, when you put it in the water and kind of rub it, it'll lather up really quick. The narrow leaf are the ones that we use to wash your hair. Like they cannot tagoda. The broadleaf ones are the ones that we use to wash our ceremonial implements, like our eagle feathers. If you wash your hair with that dark broadleaf yucca, it's really itchy. Hey, you got hands on, man. So that's why we use this one here. And then the modified leaves are also used as counters. Like in certain games, we'll create like 102 of them and use them as counters. Next slide. Here's one in flower. Next slide. So the flowers are edible on this when they're fresh. Then here are the fruits. We call this ashkandavadina. So the fruits, once they produce these fruits, you can pluck them and you can cook them like in an oven or roll them like on top of a stove and cook them and eat them fresh that way. Also, these stems here, these flowering stems, once they turn yellowish, those are also pulverized. And then you get a pinion pitch. You mix the two together, you kind of cook it and boil it, and then you put it in water. And then you sift it, you get all that residue off. The liquid that comes off of that, you can use that to treat your animals, like your cows and your sheep or pink eye. And that's how we use that as well. Next slide. Here's Rumex, Hymenocephala, Canagri Thop, Chahatini. This portion from about 6 inches off the ground to the ground, a little bit below the ground level on the stems, if you collect a whole bunch of that, you can either split them open or you can squeeze the heck out of them, just to squeeze all that middle portion out, and you can make wild rhubarb pie. Chahatini pie. And then below the ground, about a foot, maybe a little bit more than a foot, you'll find a whole bunch of tubers. They look like a whole bunch of potatoes. And those, depending on what time of the year you gather them, we use those to make a plant dye. They'll produce anything between like a light orangish to like an orange yellow to orange brown color. So those are also used as a dye plant. Next slide.
Are those leaves poisonous like rhubarb leaves?
The upper portion of it is poisonous, but we only use that small, like I said, about 5 to 6 inches above the ground. These are cattails, with their flowering portion. I like to call them corn dogs. The whole plant is used. The roots are white. When you look at them standing in water, they're white. You pull them out as much of the root as you can, then you wash out that rooty bottom. Those are edible. You can eat them fresh. The leaves are used to weave like mats. They were used to weave like sandals. They were used to weave like dresses, skirts. This portion of the flowering portion of the fruiting portion of it. when it's in that stage, you make a slit of it on one side, and then that whole thing just kind of opens up like that. Form like a big old floret, and that stuff is used for material, like for bedding material, like for pillows, like for stuffing material, like making like little toys, like dolls and stuff. Mm-hmm. And when it's still green, when this portion is still green and you can barely see like little speckles of yellow on it, that's when I go over there with my plastic bag and I'll start scraping it, real, shaking it real lightly. You get tartadine off of it, yellow pollen. Yeah, the name of this one, it's in the past, it was much more sought after than corn pollen. Yeah, and the medicine man, the real like traditional medicine man, that's what they prefer. It's a lot more yellow than corn pollen.
What do you call that
nano?
Does it look
hot? Look, eyes are regress. And then these are equisetums. I think we're almost done here. Equisetum, horsetail, common horsetail. This one has a lot of silica in its plant material here. Ashtinbeg, it means a bow smoother. And we used to grab like a whole bundle of it, and then you'll kind of fold it up, and it'll go like this. And over the rough spots, it's like sandpaper. And so that's where the common name comes from, scouring rush. A long time ago, when the pilgrims were coming across the west, they would find these in the waterways. And whenever they finished cooking at night, in the evenings or in the mornings, the ladies would go down by the waterside and grab a whole handful of this. They'll sit there while they're washing their dishes, using this as a scouring pad. Because it has a lot of silica in it, you know. And so that's where the common name comes from, is the scouring rush. And that's what we use. Next slide. This is Mount Mahogany, Turbocarpus montanus, Tetsugizi. The roots of this and also the lower bark is used. We use it to make a reddish dye. This plant and another one that grows along water was called water birch. We use that as a two-step method. Using them two plants together in that two-step method, we used to create that reddish dye for our moccasins. There's the fruiting portion of it. That's its fruit there, its seed coiled up there. Next slide. Mormon tea, Ephedra veritas. Kota?
Kota.
C-O-T-A? Yeah, I've seen that. When I'm in Utah, I kind of throw out the name just to make him feel better. So bring him tea, you know. Oze is a Navajo name. Oze. It has a natural ephedrine. We use it as a pep-up tea. And then we use it as a weight loss plant. And then another way that we use it is you get a whole bundle of that and you pulp it. When you ever have a horse that gets like hurt or like that's run into like a chain, like a fence or something, or it's been run into a branch and it's been cut, you clean out the cut real good, and then you get a bunch of this and you pulp it, and then you put that right on the cut, and you put a patch on it. It's an antiseptic for horses as well. And the trick to it is, once again, you got to know when to collect it and when to use it. Whenever you collect and see these individual long, greenish, stem-like part of the plant, you would take that and this one, you go like this here, your fingernail, you kind of run it down and make a little groove, and then you peel it this way. So on the very inside of that stem, it should be reddish maroon brown. And if it's that reddish maroon brown, then it's time to use. Sometimes if it's still kind of yellowish green, then go find another shrub. So that's a trick to knowing when its full potential properties are used or are in that plant. Next slide. Aspen, we talked about this one earlier. East Bay, there's like natural aspen, salic acid inside the bark of these. These are used for all kinds of stuff, like for carving material and also for corrals and so forth. Next slide. Okay, let's go into these little toxic plants here for a real quick short spell. These are a large group called astragalus, local weeds. Mountain Betches. There's over 400 or 500 in North America. And a lot of them are selenium concentrators. So whenever you smell that acrid saline smell, and like when you find these astragalus, then you'll know that astragalus has accumulated a lot of selenium in its makeup. And now we call the ones that are toxic the lagani. Not the means plant that makes you go blind. And the safe ones that the sheep eat, we call those the behechidi, something that the sheep will dig out their clothes. And the chilaganis, they're, like I said, selenium concentrators. Every summer we have horses that are out there, out on the ranch, that will start feeding on these. And it's like a drug to them. Once they get that selenium content built up inside their body, it becomes toxic to them. And that's all they seek out, is that plant. And they'll start staggering around like they're drunk looking for that plant. And so eventually it kills them. It's like acute selenium poisoning is what it is. So those are very, some of them are quite toxic here. Next slide.
We have some of that growing in our yard too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are fairly common. Like this one here is called Astragalus mollissimus variety Thompson eye. This one's one of the baddies. This is the ones that really concentrates selenium. The Bevanat, next slide. Then here's the more safe Astragalus natalianum, the Behechidi, the ones that sheep will dig out. Astragalus, the name of it means ankle bones. Next slide. Here's Zygodanus paniculatus, meadow death camas. So this is one of the ones that I warned you about. Like, if you think that's an onion, dig around like on the leaves and smell it. If it doesn't have an onion smell, then this is a toxic one. So this is the one that kills cattle, kills livestock, you know, kills sheep, horses. Maybe in the past it killed humans, you know. That's where the name comes from. But they're fairly common, like in the sagebrush grasslands, pinyon juniper woodlands. Next slide. Is that it?
I guess that's it.
All right, that's it. That's our last one. Wow. Can I have the lights? Okay, just something really quick here. Like I said, we've been working on this for a number of years, and with Sam on college, Ken Heil, Linda Mary Reeves, and Steve O'Kane from Northern Iowa State University. 15 to 20 years we've been working on this, and here's our product. Wow. We finally came up with a floor for the whole Four Corners region. And it covers like about 2,300, 2,400 plants. A big, large study area, almost the size of the reservation area here.
Where do they sell those?
This one's available on Amazon.com. Or else if you go to San Juan College Bookstore in Farmington, they'll have it available. They're only, what, about $80, $75? It should be about like $200. And one of the things that we did is we signed the waiver, all the authors, saying that we're not going to get any type of money, just so that we could keep the price low for the students and the audience, you know. And we have Marilyn Crawford that did the part of the watercolors.
Oh, wow.
And then Skip Van Dre from Phoenix, he did the watercolors of all the different habitats that we have. Like pinyon juniper woodland and ponderosa pine forest and so forth, hanging garden communities. It has a very descriptive key, taxonomic key, then has very descriptive about each different species. Linda Reeves was the one that produced these line drawings for us. And then towards the end of the book, we have about 500 plates of colored photos.
Oh.
So,
do they sell those at the Navajo Nation Museum?
I'm not too sure, but I think San Juan College might be their closest.
What's the name
area?
Region?
It's called Flora of the Four Corners Region. Flora of the Four Corners Region. And this is how I preserve my specimens. This is what Martin was kind of talking about earlier. Here's one that's called underneath it. Here's one that I named. This one's from Saru. Just north of Saru, right along the tops of the Entrada Sandstone on the Torada Formation. This one is a name. This one, Areognum colobum. Colobum means forming a low mound, like a mound forming plant. And it's only known from that site, from Saru. I'm afraid, I'm not too sure, but I, the last time I've been up there, I tried checking again. They closed off that section. So they might have mined out the whole thing. In one area, there was a narrow strip about the width of this room here, about twice the length of it, maybe three times across the street to that next house, about that long. This was the only place where this plant occurred at. That place also had four new species on one site.
Oh my gosh.
I described two new ones, and one of my colleagues, Steve O'Kane, named another one. So this one is actually what we would call an isotype. I've designated the holotype, and this is my isotype. So my holotype is over at New York Botanical Gardens. And then my isotypes I'm going to distribute to BYU, Brigham Young, one at the Great Aquarium at Harvard, one at Missouri Botanical Gardens, one at Rancho Santa Ana in Claremont, California, one at Salmon College, one at UNM, and then one at the U.S. Aquarium at the Philadelphia or the Smithsonian Institute. So that's how I distribute some of these types when I describe these new species. Excuse me?
Only God can grow.
And here's another one that I also collected off that same area.
Have you ever tried to have those over at Dene College?
I've fixed their collection before. It took me 10 years to hunt down their collection. And I've added like 2,000 to their collection as well. So this is one that's found just south of here, around Mexican Water, Mexican Springs, all pretty much to like almost near Crown Point. This one's called Astragalus cliffordi, another one that's named after me, Clifford's Mount Rich. It's totally perfectly adapted to the desert. See how wiry it is? It produces like very few leaves. Flowers are very small, the fruits are very small, and just because it's wiry, during the hottest part of summer, it doesn't overheat. It's able to dissipate heat, and then by the way, it forms like this, like a what we call a rush-like plant. When it rains, all these stems, they channel down the water into that central stem area. And then by producing very small leaves, and then sometimes no leaves at all, by producing very small flowers and small fruits, and also by producing scattered flowers over the whole plant, that saves it energy, that saves its water usage. So this is totally adapted to the desert. Clifford's Mount Witch. Here's one that I showed you called Aliciella clifordi, Clifford's Dinestar or Clifford's Gilia, found only from north of Red Valley area, or north of Red Valley, or yeah, Red Valley and Cove area. Here's one that I named after my grandmother, Areognum cerahei. Sarah's wild buckwheat.
Looks like a fan.
Mm-hmm. And then this one is the one that Steve described from north of Saru. This one's named Lescarella navajoensis, Navajo bladder pod. Very rare.
That's the one you said doesn't exist anymore?
These are potentially don't exist over there anymore. And then here's another one that I described earlier, Senecio clifordi. So all together I've co-published 15 new species. And right now I'm sitting on 20 more new ones. You know, throughout the whole Southwest that hasn't been described or named yet. All together, what Martin was talking about, Mr. Link here, is I have 24,000 of these. And so that's what we're...
24,000 like that. Like, so you're looking for a site where you could display all of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have the cabinets already, too. Okay, any questions, anybody?
Are many of your pressings going to have some seeds so that eventually seeds could be recovered from your pressings?
Some of them may have seeds. And then what I'm doing now is, I should have done this in the past, is out of what I'm collecting, out of the fragments and the seeds that are coming out of there, I want to start attaching small packets to them, like paper that's been folded. And inside these packets would have all these like seeds and extra flowers and extra leaf parts and stuff like that, you know? Wow. Yes?
It seems that most of your plants that you explored with are medicinal purposes and seasoning and that sort of thing, correct? Are there any plants that were more like farmed or food production, like ZMAs or something like that, which I think corn originated in the Americas. Was there any, but the major emphasis of your studies has been native plants that were not cultivated, but just were for medicinal and seasoning and that and coloring of dyes and that sort of thing, wasn't it?
Well, what I'm doing right now is like when I mentioned those four volumes that I'm working on. Mm-hmm. On the second volume, which contains the ethnobotany, I'm going to have probably about 2,000 different plants listed. And all these plants will have like scientific names, descriptions, and so forth, where it comes from, habitat. And these will also have Navajo names, Navajo classifications, like if they're diet plants, if they're medicinal plants, if they're tobaccos, if they're edible plants, if they're, you know, like ceremonial plants. Mm-hmm. And then also, I want to describe like how some of that knowledge came about, and then how some of them might have potentially used in the past to try to domesticate, you know, like for growing around homes where they don't have access to it all the time. Mm-hmm. And so, pale wolf berries is one good example out here in the Southwest. A lot of times when you find clusters of pale wolf berries, because they're kind of colonial, when you find them together, most often, maybe about 70% of the time, you'll find like some form of archaeological site that's near it. The old ancestral Puebloans, they used to go around and harvest those, and they used to cultivate them, you know, try to keep them near their structures, and so they could use it as a ceremonial food throughout their ceremonial seasons. Some of the Arizona tribes, a lot of Arizona tribes, they did that. They took agave plants from Mexico, like from northern Mexico, and transplanted them wherever they rebuilt their villages at. So when these, there's a couple of botanists from the Desert Botanic Gardens from Phoenix, they're studying agaves. And out of their studies, they're finding that some of these species that we've been finding in North America, their parent plants were coming in from like central to northern Mexico.
Right.
So you know, there's evidence for stuff like that was going on.
Thank you.
Thank you.